So, what did the... Maybe just to talk about the transition from Delaware to UCLA.
Okay.
Maybe just discuss the sort of recruitment process. How did that idea of moving even come up?
Mm-hmm.
What did that transition look like?
UCLA had been recruiting me for several years, and so had Berkeley, because they both had, it wasn't just their women's studies program, there's a separate kind of program in big universities like these two UCs. The Center for the Study of Women was not the women's studies program.
Hmm.
It had an $80,000 a year budget. Yes. And it was a home for grants from faculty who hated their departments and ran their grants through Center for the Study of Women. And we put it had a bunch of other activities. We put it at the Center for the Study of Women, which they recruited me and I took it eventually. We put on 70 or 80 lectures and conferences a year. Many joint with other departments, but probably 30 of them that we initiated. So it was a big creator of networks on campus for people interested in women's issues from the med school and the law school and the professional schools, the undergraduate schools. It was a huge operation. And I loved those huge operations. And they wanted me because Delaware wasn't in that league in terms of the women's studies program, but it was a huge program. I mean, at the time I left, it had 100 courses.
Wow.
And when I arrived at UCLA, they had 100 courses. Those weren't all paid for out of the women's studies program. They were joint, they were ones we negotiated with, or other people had negotiated with history and biology and whatnot. But it was a huge program, and we also ran a couple big lecture series, and so I'd been in that job, I don't know, 8 or 9 years, maybe more, 10 years. So I knew how to do that, though UCLA had its own challenges. So I moved to UCLA because if I was ever going to leave Delaware, I had to do it soon, or nobody would take me, it'd be too expensive. So I moved.
So when you're commuting, were you commuting to work at UCLA, or you were based here while you were working?
So let's see what happened. There's something like 5 years between when I was full-time at Delaware and when I was full-time at UCLA. And she was out here for all of those years. And so it was a mix of things. I had a sabbatical, and so I had spent it out here. And I got a visiting appointment at UCLA, spent it out here. So it was, I'd be back there for, her parents were, aged parents were not far from Delaware, over the border in Pennsylvania, so she came back east fairly often. She flew a lot, and we put in a lot of airline miles. So it was a bunch of visiting appointments, and then when I decided I wanted to move here, I think it was 2 years I was employed here full time with full pay without the kind of contract. I mean, I had tenure at two spots and it was one big administrative mess, but it wasn't my mess. And I immediately notified the top personnel officer on both campuses. I said, look, this is what's happening. If you can figure it out, go for it. But it's not my fault, and I don't want to see my name on the front page of the New York Times. Illegally holding tenure at two universities.
Right.
But there was some commuting in there. And I think I told you I was debating whether I should actually be tenured, because I didn't want to have to deal with committees. But I finally decided it was stupid to put myself at risk that way. So that's about why I moved here.
So was there an intellectual element to the timing of the transition as well? I mean, I think we spoke this morning about the report with the UN.
No, not really. No, I mean, in some ways, Delaware was more enjoyable intellectually. I mean, UCLA has been wonderful, but Delaware's half the size. Very close to Washington, D.C. and Baltimore and New York, and I was, all those UN organizations are over there, right? And they're in New York and Washington, and it wasn't a loss. It was a really different scene to move into a graduate school of education from appointments in philosophy and sociology departments. I mean, I had graduate students, but not a lot of my own, and I didn't mind that. It's a lot of work with graduate students. And here I had to figure out how to fit into this graduate school of education. They knew they wanted me. But why I wanted them was much more strategic than intellectual. I mean, it was a good setup, and they let me do whatever I wanted to do, and school was good, and I didn't have to do much teaching, and, you know. I was thinking about it, but probably not too articulately. I mean, I enjoyed it when I got here. I, you know, made wonderful, interesting friends. But it was mostly because I was directing the Center for the Study of Women. So I had 60 stellar stars coming through that I was having dinner and lunch with. I mean, all the restaurants in town knew me. The minute they saw me coming, they'd make everything good, because I was always bringing dinner tables of 8 and 12 people who go to dinner with these national and international women's studies stars. And I got to meet people in other departments that way too, and had developed some wonderful intellectual friends. So it's been very successful, but I didn't move for that. Because at Delaware, I was in the middle of the larger Philadelphia intellectual community. I had friends at Temple and colleagues at Temple and University of Pennsylvania in particular. I mean, we had dinner all the time, and we're in various groups together and so forth. And so I had a very rich, and it was an hour from Hopkins, and I lived in Baltimore sometimes. Once my kids left home, I moved to Baltimore a couple of years, and then I moved to Philly a couple of years, and down in Washington and in New York. So they're very different intellectual communities I was in. The thing I missed most here, that I was conscious of missing was at Delaware. I'd had a very rewarding presence in the local Black intellectual community, and that wasn't the case here. I mean, I had acquaintances here, Black and in the intellectual communities, but nothing like the East Coast Black intellectual community. They all take holidays out on Block Island or wherever it is. You go out there and the entire community is Black intellectuals and professionals from the East Coast and everywhere. And the Delaware Black community, Philadelphia, Delaware, was a very self-conscious community, and it's a small enough area, and they'd been through hell together. And they were very happy to have people like me involved with them. And, you know, coming, wasn't doing anything organizational, but I was present and appreciating them and going out to dinner with some of them. And that was harder to do here. So I missed that.
This was, so you'd mentioned that the period where you were overlapping Delaware and UCLA was really prolific because you had a lot of free time. Since
yeah.
you weren't doing a lot mm-hmm. of the service stuff on your campus. Mm-hmm. When you transitioned to UCLA and were doing this sort of 60 scholars
mm-hmm.
taking to dinner, did you find that you shifted more into an administrative role, or were you still able to keep up your...
I found on both campuses that administration versus teaching has a very different annual chronology, if I can put it that way.
Okay.
So in at the beginning and end of each term, I would never travel when I had these administrative positions. I'd always be there because that's when everything happens at the beginning and end. You're scheduling this and dealing with the dean about that and what new students and teaching. But then in the middle of the semester, I'd have like 2 months of almost free time. I mean, stuff was going on, but I could travel while all this was going on here because I always had an administrator who managed the office. I mean, I got involved in establishing some of these programs, but never from scratch. I was lucky or strategic enough never to take a position where I'd have to kill myself trying to get the thing established. This was very well established already. It was secure. The administration didn't dare go anywhere near it. And so, like September, I'd have to be here. But October and November, I could be anywhere I wanted as long as I was back by December. Because then all kinds of fires would flame up and I'd have to start getting ready at the beginning of the next term. So I did a lot of writing on that kind of schedule. The summers in both cases were pretty much free times for writing. I wrote most of my books in these administrative, while I was holding these administrative positions at both Delaware
mm-hmm.
and UCLA. Full-time teaching, you can't get that kind of time, and you can't get I couldn't get the intellectual separation from
mm-hmm.
a full-time teaching position to do it. When I ended, when the journal Science left, Science was a little different. When I was editing for 5 years, it's a 12-month job. Those manuscripts arrived 400 a year. We only accepted, I think, 8%. So my co-editor and I were doing a lot of reading of manuscripts and negotiating with authors and had a big staff. And it's a 12-month-a-year job. So that was a little different. But we did have each other and forced each other to take, in effect, sabbaticals. Quarters off because we had enough staff that we could manage it. And we got the staff raised. It was a whole line higher when the journal left us than it had been when it arrived. And so, and UCLA does not permit people who take these editing jobs to have their research suffer. So for almost 20 years, I only taught half time and had the other two fourth in graduate schools with doctoral programs. That's a full course, a year load, and for full time. So I was teaching two courses a year, which after it was peanuts, you know. After a while, so I could do a lot of writing on these administrative positions, even the Science one. And when Science left, in 2005, what is that, 13 years ago, I have suffered ever since. Because I adored the secretaries. I paid for their babies to go to nursery school. They adored me. They totally spoiled me. I didn't even know how to look up a faculty address online. When I was thrown into my own resources, it was hell. And you can, right now you can hear my technological limitations. And that was created because I was so pampered by the staff. It was interesting.
Yeah, it seems like it's you. So you directed the Center for Study of Women '96 to 2000, and then were the editor, co-editor of Science from 2000 to 2005. So did you know? Did you need something to replace it, or did you take over Science because you were free all of a sudden? Like, what?
It was a huge achievement to get it to move to UCLA. And it was a huge benefit to UCLA because a lot of faculty were involved with it in a very wonderful way. And we, Kate and I, decided to shift the direction of the journal significantly. It was a grand old lady at that point. It was 26 years old or something like that when we got it. So, it, you know, it was the first big interdisciplinary women's studies journal, international women's studies journal. I mean, you could find it on every coffee table in the engineering department in Yugoslavia. I mean, they were trying to show they were feminists. They'd have signs on the coffee table. And we shifted it to an international focus from a fundamentally U.S. focus. And that took a lot of recruitment of articles, recruitment of reviewers. I mean, you know, I'm in that again now in another context. But it, no, it was fun to do. It was a stretched me in kinds of good ways, and I mean, I was had administered pretty good things, but this, and you know, done all kinds of editing, but not this. And when you publish in journals, you don't really understand how they work. You understand them from what you need to understand from your perspective, peer reviews, and they say no, and you say what's happening, and there's a, you know, whatever. But there's a lot of infrastructure that has to be maintained, and a lot more when you're founding a journal. It's driven me crazy.
I'd like to come back to the strong objectivity
generation
and think about the, I just don't want to lose track of it in terms of the chronology.
Okay.
And I think we've touched on a few little pieces here and there. Its relationship to the Strong Program, its relationship to the Science Wars. But if we could just maybe do a short, not prescribing
history
that, but
something.
Just, but you know, kind of a, you know, a bit of an intellectual history of the emergence of the of strong objectivity for you, and what was driving that, what you wanted. It's, you're so intentional, because you've described yourself as being very intentional in terms of making these strategic choices, you know.
Yeah.
Where does strong objectivity fit into that for you?
Okay, so I was trying to look up, and I can't quite, I'd have to do more research in my own history to come up with that. But in founding standpoint methodology, standpoint epistemology, the issue was objectivity. From the beginning, we were in biology, Ruth Hubbard was saying, biology is not objective in the way it understands women's bodies, and in sociology, and Patricia Hill Collins, and I mean, we were always saying that they think they're objective, but they're actually deep, their thinking is deeply, they're very categories, their episteme, their whole way of thinking about the issue is deeply shaped by the fact that it's they who are doing it, it's their lives. Dorothy Smith provided some really useful sound bites on this. She talked about the conceptual practices of power. And she talked about how sociology works up the messy, everyday chaos of life into the kinds of categories and the relationship between them that permits ruling. that permits the education department or the welfare department or the World Bank to manage things, because sociology, she's saying, well, there are other disciplines involved, but she's a sociologist, has worked up these categories and causal relations between them in ways that make management visible, how to manage them visible. Because otherwise, how would you know what to do when you want to stop a rebellion from happening in this education department or whatever? I mean, you could kill them in the old mode. But in the modern society, she argues, rule conceptually. It's their conceptual organization and practices that rule. So she was writing that in 1972. I mean, I didn't encounter her work until probably 70, wait a minute, am I a decade off? 82, maybe 89? I think 82. When's Patricia Hill Collins? Is she 89? Gotta get a bibliography. I think that's right. 89. Yeah, so she was already, made a presentation at the Pacific Coast American Sociological Association. And I think it's 82. Excuse me, I've got the essays right here, so I'm just going to look at them. Because I put them in one volume on purpose, so everybody could figure out what was happening. And now I need to figure out what was happening, because I can't remember what's in here. But I think I've got them in chronological order. Women's Perspective as a Radical Critique of Sociology. Where's the acknowledgments? Okay, let's see. IX. Dorothy Smith. 1974. Okay, it was in Sociological Inquiry in 1974. So I think she gave that paper in 72, as I remember. Mm-hmm. But the rest of us didn't get to it until 79, so let's take Hillary Rose, 1983. Okay, let's take Hartsock. When did my thing come out? I've got it in here. Hartsock is 90. Oh, Hartsock is 83. Okay, so there we go. Rose is 83. Hartsock is 83. Harding is, the one in here is 93, but that was into the strong, rethinking standpoint of epistemology, what is strong objectivity? I was rethinking, that's a later essay. Collins is 97. Wait a minute, I want the other one. Collins is 86. So, this gives you a sense of the objectivity issues were there from the beginning, but I wanted to grab them and get a sound bite, get a little something that nobody could resist reading, right? So I don't know, I fussed around thinking about it and finally decided strong objectivity would be the strategically, who could resist that? So I pulled that out of all of our work. And I'm embarrassed to say that these days people usually cite only me. They often don't cite all these other people. And we were working together, not initially, but eventually. We all met each other and were writing to each other and putting them on the same panels at the ASA or the APSA or whatever for us. And so it was really a team of us that were doing this, coming from different disciplines, which made some very big distinctions in how we formulated standpoint theory. Dorothy Smith hated the language of feminist standpoint. She said, that's high theory girls. I want women's standpoint. It's the standpoint of women in their everyday lives. How come they have a double day of work? How come the courts say they asked for it when they got raped, and so forth and so on. She said, feminist standpoint is after you guys, this wasn't exactly your language, but it's the idea, got finished with working this up into some fancy philosophical thing. And you've taken the agency away from the women. So this is, I'm saying this just to say that there were very big distinctions. And Hilary Rose had come from the sociology of science. She and Stephen Rose had written, they were Marxists, and they're both Marxist organizers in London. Do you know them at all? No? You can look them up, they're very interesting. He's a biologist. And where had he been? He was at London School of Economics or something like that, and she was somewhere north, I forget. But she had been, was living with a scientist and been working in the sociology of science. So she brought a somewhat different perspective. And of course, Patricia Hill Collins had started off, because she was a sociologist, she knew Dorothy Smith's work, but she was speaking from a black U.S. perspective. But she was very much not a student of Smith's, but in Smith's way of line of thinking, as opposed to mine or Hilary Rose's or Nancy Hartsock in political theory. I was probably closer to political theory with Nancy because philosophy, the courses in political science and in philosophy that are called political theory are fundamentally the same course. I mean, they're taught differently, but they start with Plato and Hobbes, and you know, you work your way up to John Rawls, and it's the same syllabus in both courses. And I didn't take those courses, but I knew what they looked like. So, let me see your question. What was your question again? Sorry, I lose track of it.
Yeah, just kind of coming out and thinking about what was the trajectory of strong objectivity.
Yeah. But I've had, we'll get to this at some point. Let me put it that way. I've had it for a while, I got to get back in there and rethink some of these things. Because the early ways we put standpoint theory, all of us, and certainly the way I put strong objectivity, was not about a pluriverse. It was about one true story and we were going to tell it. And I don't subscribe to that anymore. And so I've been kind of nudging the theory around the edges in that direction, but I haven't directly confronted the fact that this is a big change that has to be recognized in this theory, that there's no one right story of the world. And I don't care what you think, you physicists. Yes, there's a world out there. There's lots of worlds out there. Mm-hmm. And your world isn't the only one. Indigenous people have a very different world out there. It has its categories and ways of being organized are just different. And there can't be any one true way. Different ways are useful for different kinds of projects. And if you want to get to the moon, it's best not to use indigenous understandings of the world, or at least at present, it's best. But if you want to improve environmental issues, it would be much better if you used indigenous understandings of the world than NSFs. So I've been, you know, talking that talk for probably a decade without directly confronting the whole large issue that standpoint theory tends still to be understood by, for example, in classrooms. It's, wow, now we got the one true story. And that is the way I was thinking of it, as I know that in the beginning. I mean, Marxism thought it had the one true story. The Enlightenment thinks it has the one true story. And there I was, a child of the Enlightenment and Marxism, and not my fault.
Did you get any pushback from your colleagues, the authors that you named, around the language of strong and weak? I know that was meant to be a provocation.
No, I didn't. No.
It wasn't seen as overly aggressive or belligerent.
They didn't mind aggression. And I didn't. I mean, what did we think we were doing? You're taking on objectivity, we're not being aggressive. I mean, that, you know, the critics' language, they just couldn't believe that girls would have the nerve to think that they could redefine objectivity just shows you what's wrong with girls. You know, we were so used to that in each of our disciplines that I didn't get any response to it. There's a certain point when all of us stopped writing on it except me. I can't think when. I mean, that's probably not the right way to put it. I mean, Nancy Hartsock died some years ago, and I think Dorothy Smith died fairly recently. I'm not sure. I can't remember. And she definitely continued writing, but she wrote very much in a sociological context. She always was about reforming sociology. I mean, that was, she didn't care what I did in philosophy. She wanted to do sociology. She was very irascible, and I loved her.
So it's interesting. So I think a lot of the co-authors and also just colleagues, some of your fellow travelers during this period, you've mentioned several times that they had these reform agendas for their discipline.
Yes.
Yours doesn't seem to have been focused on philosophy whatsoever.
No, that's right.
You were using those tools, but not necessarily to transform philosophy.
No, even though they and I had the same end goal.
Which was what?
To serve the social justice movement. But they did it through focusing on the conceptual practices of power in their particular disciplines, that the way political science characterizes women gives, I mean, that kind of argument I gave, replicated of Dorothy Smith, appeared in those disciplines, that those disciplines are so powerful that we have to change the way they conceptualize everyday reality. And I was doing that too, but I didn't care about philosophy of science. I mean, I've only gotten back into philosophy recently. I'm not in it, but this last book is the first book in decades where I've even probably mentioned the word, where I've clearly focused it on philosophy.
But you were still attending annual meetings, is that right?
Of the APA?
Of the APA, of the Philosophy of Science Association.
No, I haven't gone to the Philosophy of Science Association for 30 years. They were so rude to me 1 year. It was so bad. I mean, I'm used to bad. This was so bad. That I thought, I don't need to do this to myself. This is terrible. I mean, yeah.
When was this?
Can I remember? It must have been in the 80s or 90s, maybe late 80s.
And what happened?
So there was an invited panel. Me, Helen Longino, and Allison Wiley. Is that right? I think that's right. And we each gave our papers. And so Philosophy of Science Association was probably 85% men. It was at Pittsburgh or somewhere, a huge room. And afterwards, first Noretta Kirchy. Do you know Noretta Kirchy? She's an eminent, she's an ex-student of Popper's and an eminent philosopher of science and counts herself as a feminist and in terms of doing things for women in the discipline she does it. I forget, there were skylights or something. She's a redhead. And this kind of golden light, she was sitting in the second row or something, came down and lit up her hair. And this red, golden-haired woman stood up, and she just launched a whole diatribe against me in particular. Allison and Helen, she didn't attack so much. And then the guys started. I was the focus of it. Allison and Wiley weren't. And I was probably talking about strong objectivity. I can't remember. But even my dear friend Joe Rouse, do you know Joe Rouse? I mean, he and I are buddies. We went to we had the same advisors, and he went to NYU. We were the only two philosophers of science we knew who met at NYU. He took me aside later, and he said, "No, Sandra, that was really a bit too much what you were doing." But, whoa.
So it wasn't a reaction to you, it was a reaction to what you had presented?
Yeah, of course. I mean, it always was a reaction to what I'm presenting.
Well, sometimes.
Well,
sometimes that's just an excuse to raise your hand so you could dig into someone who you got a bone to pick with.
I never thought there were any personal bones that people were picking with me, except that for philosophers, what you think is a personal bone. But and people were, some guys were, and women were criticizing feminism, and some saying they were largely attacking STS, but I've always been very kindly and sweet and go out to tea with whoever's criticizing me, and try to quiet everybody down and have my own assessments. I'm not revealing about the stupidity that I'm exhibiting, and I'm pretty strategic in these ways, and I don't feel guilty about doing that. So I don't mount attacks on other people either. I once said a few sentences that Helen Longino didn't like, and I've been so sorry I said it, and that was 40 years ago, 30 years ago or something like that. So I don't attack other individuals.
And so that was the end of your time at PSA?
That's the end of my time at PSA.
So did you,
because at that point, I wish I could remember when I started going to 4S. But let me add to it that, so APAs I go to if they invite me on the program, I go. If I know it's going to be in LA, sometimes I propose a panel and it gets accepted. But otherwise I don't go to it. And when I haven't been on the program, I can't think. But that's true for, there are no conferences I go to if I'm not on the program. I can't think when I've gone to one, when I wasn't on. I mean, if I know it's coming and want to go, I get on the program because it's more fun that way.
So do you think that some of the things that were found challenging at PSA opened new opportunities for a conversation with, and we don't have to use 4S synonymous with science studies. I mean, I think I want to keep that space open for you.
Oh, that's interesting.
To think, was there a larger intellectual community, a different intellectual community you found yourself in conversation with because of this kind of movement from logic and epistemology into the epistemology as it related to science, which now is becoming a more centralized focus of your work. And you did reference earlier just its at least linguistic relationship to the Strong program.
Mm-hmm.
But were there other intellectual collaborations that were opening up, or was
I was talking to Peg Jacob a lot. She was at this point in fellowship. She had, I'd met, Peg Jacob, Margaret Jacob, on the cultural meanings of the scientific revolution. She's a historian of the scientific revolution fundamentally, and has written quite a few books on it. And she had initially been at, in New York City, down on 14th Street, the New School. And then she moved to, when I knew her, she was at Penn, maybe? She's married to Lynn Hunt. You know Lynn Hunt?
Mm-hmm.
History of Science?
Yeah.
They're both at UCLA now. They came a few years after I came. And Lynn had been at University of Pennsylvania. She's a historian of the French Revolution, I think, or something. Sexuality.
Can you say sociology here?
History.
At UCLA.
At UCLA. And I think Peggy has retired. Lynn hasn't, I'm not sure. I haven't seen them in some time because my work got too crazy for them to be able to tolerate. They wrote a paper together on truth or something like that at a point when I was not a fan of truth. But I was reading historians and I was reading Bloor and Barnes and I was, with, I can't think what took me to England a couple times for a couple weeks. Got invited to something or other. So I got to meet a lot of those Brits, and I remember that is where I met Bloor there. I think I've met Barnes way back then too, but he stopped being so central in science studies while Bloor continued a little more, I don't know. And I met, Bob Young and Les Levedow and some of the other Brits, and so I was kind of developing my own.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think of it that way, but I mean, I'd made a point of going to their talks, and if they were coming into my area, wherever it was, I'd go and introduce myself to them. And I got to know Trevor Pinch quite well. Well, this is later. That's interesting. I was actually developing, I think, get a better description for what I was doing. I was developing my own science studies friendship network.
Yeah.
I had almost no one at Delaware. The program that Delaware had that was great, but it didn't. I kind of interacted with it, but it was never what I was doing. They had a fabulous history of technology program because they had the whole DuPont set up. And what was that? They had museum studies, and they had something about the history of technology and materials, something or other. I forget what it was. They had a bunch of these programs that drew off the DuPont archives and museums and whatnot, winter tour. And
yeah, the collaboration with the Hagley.
Yeah, the Hagley, yes. Who was it? There were two people over there. Peter, I'm forgetting his last name, was... Our work didn't really coincide, but it was interesting, and there were several other people over there. But that's the closest I came to having anybody at Delaware. In Philadelphia, there weren't that many science studies people. Mm-mm.
So we were kind of joking that, especially on the UK side and the Strong program and its relationship, that so much of that work is grounded philosophically in Wittgenstein.
Oh, that's interesting.
And
it was.
Whether or not your many years of trying to steer clear of Wittgenstein, how that, what that experience, that encounter was like for, especially for the early work by Bloor and Barnes and others.
I ignored it. I would see it in the text on it. My eyes would glaze over and I'd go on to the next paragraph. I knew what they were drawing on and go for it. But I wasn't going to get myself into it.
Yeah.
It wasn't a disqualifier, though, for
no.
Bloor.
No, I'm not a negative about the importance of Wittgenstein.
Yeah.
I just had my own very personal reasons for I've done Wittgenstein. I'm out of that.
Yeah.
I mean, for several reasons, I wanted to stay out of Hal's way. And then I got really pissed. He came over into my area. Did he write a paper on Quine? I think he wrote a paper on Quine. I was enraged. We had been separated for 15 years by this time or whatever. I thought, you have your nerve. He got excited by it and started to get into it. I'm not clear. I'm not sure he got into it through my work. Maybe he did, maybe not. Quine was a big figure at that point.
It's interesting to hear you talk about philosophers because in them, as sociologists and social theory, particularly through mentorship, particularly through mentors who are known for defining a field, it is very much like you need to pick your team. And so, for example, you find out so-and-so is a Bourdieusian, and the youth are okay with that. Like, these are just names with ideas.
Yeah.
But when you reach a certain level, it's like to identify with a thinker is to assume their baggage as well and their enemies and all that. And it's curious to hear you talk about it, too, because it's...
I think that's more about me.
It's a personal thing?
Yeah, because, I mean, I wrote on Quine and I admired him, but I was very critical of him. My dissertation is critical of him because it's not his fault, but he couldn't, in fact, separate himself when push came to shove from positivism. And I did a little of that in my dissertation, not a lot. But subsequently, almost never related to, Quine gets a tiny footnote on page 274. I mean, I haven't been in the Quine circle, if there is such a thing.
I guess I'm just tickled that the philosophers are not immune to the players themselves.
Are you kidding?
Well, but I think you're also highlighting that there's this... I'm not quite sure how to phrase it yet, and so maybe I don't know if I should wait, but I think that there's this critical mass bubbling up of there's a lot breaking down in and around epistemology, so no matter which horse you picked,
Yeah.
Whether it was Quine, whether it was Wittgenstein, whether it was, you know, kind of thinking about what the consequences of the and the future of the logical positivists were going to be. Something was amiss, but everybody's kind of writing their own.
Yeah.
And at the same time, there's I think, just listening for the time that we've been together, that it's unclear in the philosophical circles whether or not they really want to have that debate.
That's right.
And it's also unclear on the science study side whether or not they really want the philosophers hanging out with them.
That's always been the case.
And the philosopher, such as a Bloor, has to basically repaint himself a sociologist.
Oh, that's interesting.
To find himself welcomed into there. And I don't know if he would accept that characterization, but I think, you know, you look at his, you know, he's a philosopher by training.
But he is
painted by philosophers as a sociologist.
Yes, I always think of him as a sociologist, and I actually know he's a philosopher. I'm the first philosopher who got the Bernal Prize. Yeah. I mean, because Forrest was defined against philosophy of science. And I rarely meet philosophers there.
Right.
And so I asked Trevor and Paul Edwards and people to check back as I looked at the list of Bernals. And there were a few names there I didn't recognize from past years. I said, are any of those philosophers? They said, we have no idea. We'll check around. And when they came back, they said, we can't find any who are.
And yet I think what you've shown is that the philosophers had a lot to do with troubling the foundation that allowed some of this to happen, right? Things were put on rocky standing because of opening up questions about the privileging of knowledge.
So who are you thinking of that I'm talking about who are these philosophers?
Well, I think just the discussion in and around like how we reinterpret, how we might now think about the place of Quine in this lineage. Reinterpretations of Kuhn, thinking that he's really just coming in looking for historical case studies and looking for a better pedagogical set of tools, but accidentally opens the door to, well, if we're not making decisions about the failure of theory based on actual evidence, we're doing it for community reasons.
Yeah.
That's a social reason. You've just opened up the door for others to come in.
See philosophers doing that.
Yeah. No, what I
think they're historians and sociologists doing that with Kuhn and with this whole
But thing. I think philosopher I guess what I'm and maybe I'm reading too much into your experiences. The kinds of questions you were asking about what Quine was up to showed the disruption that the sociologists and the others kind of flooded into and said, thank you for opening the door for us.
Yeah, like, but they knew they were doing that.
Yeah.
I mean, you guys knew what sociology was doing. I mean, 4S was really clear about its founding. Those early people were against the standard philosophy of science. And Kuhn and, got his name up this morning, Problems of Science, and it's Jerome Rabbits. And certainly Feyerabend. I recently had occasion, fortunately it fell apart, but there it is, to go back and read some Feyerabend, who'd been very important for me initially. Feyerabend and Hansen, that Lakatos volume on Kuhn. Lakatos and Musgrave, maybe that collection of papers on Kuhn. Those were really important to me. So anyway, I think you compliment philosophy too much. I don't see it that way. But I do notice an ornery streak in me that might not be entirely intellectual and just plain ornery, that I refuse to be captured by any of these. I mean, I'm always somehow positioning myself. I'm friendly and try to learn from them, but I'm not your servant. Forget it. I know I have that tendency.
First child.
Yeah, first of all. Excuse me for a minute.
Yeah.
Are we ready for a glass of wine or no?
Sure.
Okay. Yeah. Occasion that led me to spend a couple weeks. I have 3 or 4 books of his that I bought that I, you know, read 40 years ago or whatever. Reread them because there's a collection on Feyerabend coming out. I can't think of the editors right now, but if you want to know, I can give them to you. And they invited me to contribute to their volume. And this is an attempt to, they think Feyerabend's been unjustly neglected historically. And they're trying to resuscitate him for today. And I didn't want to do, I don't, you know, I've mentioned it, I don't know why they got to me, but they did. And I thought about it, and then I thought, great, but I'm going to do what I want to do. And I didn't want to do a traditional philosophy essay about Feyerabend. So I had been thinking about, so this is about working with Tapuia, and I'd been thinking about some of the challenges that I from the North, faced in working with them. Because in working with Latin American STS, because it has all kinds of conditions that are unexpected. And I educate myself, I try to be a good ethnographer the minute I get involved in these situations and try to figure out how they're thinking about things. But, so I thought, well, I'll tell, there's a particular story, so I thought I'd talk about book reviews. I'd talk about something very concrete and talk about how the very different realities of Latin America made huge problems for Tapuia, and how I tended initially in each case to conceptualize it as a problem with Latin Americans, and then quickly realized that that was a very colonial position to take. The reason they had those problems is because of the residues of colonialism. So that was the theme of the paper. And how did I connect this with Feyerabend? Well, I argued that I was doing what Feyerabend had done. He'd gone back and told a very detailed history of certain moments in the history of physics to make his point. And I was going into the nitty-gritty everyday stuff of book reviews. It was my job to organize these for Tapuia. It was one headache after another. Yeah, well, I mean, I'm in a Latin American Studies reading group here that's been going for, I don't know, 3 or 4 or 5 years maybe. And we're precisely reading all this pluriverse literature now, and it's really incredible. And three of the, I call them Latin American Studies because that's how it started. Three of them work in Latin America, and one of them is Honduran, and she's here, but that's her history. And then we added one of the founders of Sinophone Studies,
okay,
of Chinese post-colonialism, China's colonial practices up through the present day even, and Margie Waller, who's originally an Italian study Dante scholar, but works on European colonialism in ways I'd never, she knows the details. I mean, there was a moment, I forget, 1700s maybe, I forget, which she revealed to us, none of us knew it, when England almost became a colony of Spain. There was a marriage planned between a British princess and a Spanish prince, and at the last minute it got called off. But if it had gone through, England would have been a colony of Spain. Isn't that something? Who knew? So we have a very good time, and we're reading all this pluriverse literature now. And I just ordered a new book that I can't wait to read that's exactly on the issue I was talking about. It's called Decolonizing Solidarity. And it's by, it's about a, I think, Anglo-Australian who's very involved in the Australian Indigenous movement and is very critical of how white Northerners tend to get involved in these literatures and these projects, but that's exactly the issue.
Great cover.
So this is just so far away from even from philosophy of science. It's just, I mean, standard U.S. philosophy of science is just out in some other stratosphere than they're in. But that's their problem, not mine.
Sorry, I was out of the room. What was the prompt for this story?
It was, there was no prompt. We were talking about that history of philosophy of science and responses to Kuhn, and Fire Robin was in there, and I wanted to mention that he was the only one of that group that was very clearly positioning himself in light of the social movements of the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And he taught at Berkeley, and he's married to a Latin American. He was married to a Latin American. I forget where she was from. Okay, that's a side trip. You can leave it in if you want. It's not scandalous, at least.
Yeah. Everything stays in until you say otherwise.
Okay.
We can pretty much go anywhere we want. I was wondering about the Society for Women in Philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And what your involvement with them was like, and you know what you took from them and where you diverged.
Mm-hmm. I don't think I diverged at all. Within philosophy, there are these two groups: the Committee on the Status of Women, which is an official part of the APA, and which SWIP insisted on. I mean, SWIP got it in place, and which does surveys of colleges and is a site for complaints about bad practices. And I mean, it's an official body, and people get elected to it, and they're appointed by the APA. But SWIP was the grassroots organization, and they exist in every discipline that we put ourselves together back in. Let me see, the first SWIP, my friend Ann Gary here, formed the first Pacific SWIP, and that was the year I was in Canada writing my dissertation, so that would have been, oh my God, I'm so sorry, I keep forgetting when I got my dissertation, 73, maybe, 72, 3. And I think she formed it in 71. I was on the East Coast at that point, and it was 70. When I got back from my dissertation, it was already founded. And so we had meetings at the APA. As you may or may not know, the APA doesn't meet as a whole. It mm-hmm. has a divisional structure,
okay.
the East Coast, the Midwest, and the Pacific Coast. The East Coast, in effect, functions as the national because it occurs at the right time of the year for the job interviews, all right, it always comes in. It used to be between the Christmas and New Year's, and I think they've moved into a week into early January. And the other two are like at the end of March and the end of April. The East Coast one is just humongous. I mean, it's huge in job applicants and everything. And so we formed in all those divisions. And it was partly consciousness raising and networking,
mm-hmm.
and partly developing agendas. So, for example, we trained we brought in our graduate students, and we trained ourselves and the graduate students. We'd hold practice sessions of various sorts to sit in the front row at a lecture, at a presentation, and always ask a question.
Mm-hmm.
So women started showing up in the front row of all of these and asking significant questions. We trained, we practiced getting a question and not a diatribe going on or a thesis going on forever. We held practice job interviews and helped people deal with unusual, difficult circumstances. I can remember being interviewed by, I forget what university it was, but it was like 12 guys, and the interview was in a bedroom, and I was sitting on the bed with whatever kind of skirt, it wasn't a mini skirt, but and they're standing in chairs around. It was pathetic. That's not just a pathetic.
Yeah.
It's like a caricature. You can't imagine. It's like a caricature of patriarchy. And everybody, they were just all, So we got principles put in at the APA. All interviews occur at tables. They do not occur with the interviewee sitting on a double bed in the middle of the room with a bunch of guys standing around. So we did all these. I mean, they're very funny in retrospect. But we did all of these kinds of training ourselves to be more powerful presences in philosophy and to make demands on philosophy in a lot of ways. Let me see. We got the journals doing... The journals were not doing blind reviewing in philosophy. And we got them doing it. We insisted on it. It turned out they never still don't do it in physics. You know why? Can you guess why they don't do blind reviewing? Because everybody knows where they are anyway. The minute they describe what the research project is with some multi-billion dollar nuclear reactor or something, everybody knows.
There's only one guy with that.
Well, there's 150 of them according to the
title
of the paper. But So we did that kind of research, and we got the APA. We got APA policies changed about hiring, about publishing, appropriate behavior on platforms or whatever as they came up. And we got the Commission on the Status of Women established to be an official APA committee and with a site for complaints and so forth. And we networked. So we met at the APAs, but we also met twice a year at people's houses or campuses. It was so fun. I mean, it would be Friday night through Sunday morning. So I can remember driving. I met wonderful people because we'd drive on the East Coast, from Delaware up to Massachusetts or somewhere. So we'd have the long drives together. And then we'd arrive and 30 feminist philosophers would be making spaghetti in the kitchen. We'd all be eating, and we'd be sleeping in people's houses and have sessions sitting around the living room and spend, a day or two, day and two evenings or something like that. So it was incredibly bonding. And I organized the East Coast one initially and kept organizing it. And I went to those SWIP meetings, every one of them, for probably 10 years, something like that. Let me see, I know when I stopped, it would have been 85, because then I became director of women's studies and had so many meetings I just couldn't go to all of them. But the SWIP ones were so important, and they created just wonderful networks of us knowing each other and helping each other out and mentoring our, we'd bring our graduate students to these. And we had men were, the Midwest one, Central one, didn't permit men. They were very radical. Hmm. We did. But on the East Coast and West Coast, we welcomed men. We did have a few men who came to these meetings. They still meet, and I get that we have a Southern California SWIP that meets once or twice a year. It never meets, and Gary and I co-organize it in different ways. And it has a somewhat different format. We turned it into an evening, kind of afternoon evening salon, with two brief presentations by people from Southern California. But we can get up to 40 people. I can't have it. I mean, this living room is about the size of my last living room. And I mean, I could handle 15 people here, but I can't get beyond that. So, but and Gary lives in Beverly Hills, and has a huge spread. And Kaylee's out in next to Caltech, the next town over. And so she has a big place. And so they're great.
Do you see your earlier organizing efforts with SWIP being regenerated in younger philosophers?
All those groups still run.
But are they being run by 30-year-old philosophers?
Yeah, there's a continual influx of them. I haven't been to them apart from the way we do our one here, and there's various structures of them have come into existence and gone out of existence. Mm. So there's been a Boston one and a New York City one, and I think there was an Austin, Texas one. The Texas one lasted for a while. The New York City one has lasted forever. And there's a big population of people around there, and I don't know what formats they're using these days. Mm. But it's in general, it's just a great way to network women, graduate students, and these days men want the feminist input, and they want to identify that way. Mm-hmm. I mean, not a lot of them, but we get some brave ones.
other organizations I'm thinking here, like, so you were having trouble putting down your first 4S. Did you go regularly to 4S after that? Or?
Yeah.
Okay.
Not to always. I mean, when they went to Tokyo, I didn't. You know, the foreign ones. I've gotten very sick of travel, but I have gone to some foreign ones. I went to European ones. Have I been once anywhere else? I don't think so. Leandro is hosting 2022 in Puebla. I have told him innumerable times he's crazy and out of his mind. He just smiles and does it. And it was on the last 4S newsletter that 2022 will be in Puebla.
It's official.
I mean, Puebla's not that big. It's a beautiful place to go. The Andes are visible nearby, and the university is gorgeous, and it's all wonderful. Mm-hmm. And he's a terrific organizer, but it's my duty to tell him how crazy he is to host that. But he knows what to do. He's going to get 4S to provide all kinds of assistance. He's very close with West Shrum. Do you know West Shrum?
I do know West Shrum.
They're on research teams together. He's worked with West for a long time, and he just calls up West, and West organizes whatever he wants. So, hey.
Mm-hmm. Have you been involved with 4S more, like, beyond an attendee and a presenter? Have you had had any role in leadership?
I've been invited and turned it down. I get all kinds of organizing and attractive stuff, but I just can't do it anymore. I figure people are lucky I'm alive. they should just tolerate that I'm alive. I'm not going to go at 84 organizing anything. Forget it. Unless it's something I want to do. I turned down, oh, yes, East, EASTS. It just invited me onto their top editorial board. Mm. I'd been on the background board. And it's the other journal that is most similar to Tapuia. It's actually very different from Tapuia financially and in a lot of ways, but it's similar. And we have joint projects together. ESTS and Tapuia has a project this year and a project next year that'll happen, and they're great. And I turned it down. And I left it there for 2 days in case I weakened.
Mm-hmm.
But by the end of 2 days, I felt, I have so much work going on, and I'm not going to go to meetings. I don't review papers for journals. I'm not, except under extraordinary circumstances. Because I'm reviewing them for Tapuia all the time, and it's a lot of work. Tapuia is a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I want to put my energies. They're useful there. It's hard to find somebody like me. I'm working on working my way out of these jobs for Tapuia.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not easy to find people who are familiar enough with Latin American SDS to be involved with that, want to do it, and have the editing and copy editing skills and organizing skills that I have for. I mean, Leandro does it and other people do it too. I don't mean to take all the credit for it, but I can do kinds of infrastructural things they can't do.
Right.
A, they can't do, and B, sometimes they won't do. They're too shy. I can negotiate with Taylor and Francis in my tough girl mode ways they would never do. They're so polite and deferential because they've been rejected by all the Taylor and Francis journals, right? And they don't... They're 38 to 41. I mean, they're not my generation. But my generation there will have very little to do with those journals. And they've done humongous work to get STS courses, departments, journals, Spanish language journals, and so they've done huge institutional work in Latin America under extremely difficult conditions. I mean, not only the difficulty of doing these jobs, but in the political context there, in Argentina and Venezuela, and, I mean, it's a whole other story there. So there are things I can do and know how to do and enjoy doing. I mean, I enjoy working with Taylor and Francis. And
mm-hmm.
We bring those guys into our Skypes and take them to dinner. We let them take us to dinner once, and then they take us to dinner at 4S. And they love being part of it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for Taylor and Francis, it's a total plus that they got to do this, because this is an incredible wedge for them into Latin American journal publishing of any sort. So every time I try, right now I'm trying to work out getting indexed by Latin American journals. They did a terrific indexing job on all the main European journals. And we had Justin and Paul, our editors, Taylor and Francis, into our Skype 2 weeks ago, I think it was, and the topic was indexing. Because Leandro and I wanted to make sure, A, that all our editorial team understood what the indexing was. Of course, they know it better than we would know it in some ways, because their careers are so much more dependent on getting indexed by these, by Scopus and World of Science and all these big international. But in other ways, they don't exactly know what goes into this. And Paul and Justin prepared a wonderful list. I mean, there was, I don't know, 25 indexers that they had already indexed us. We only knew about three of them because those were the big ones. But there turned out to be all these other little indexes. However, they'd never been indexed by a Latin American indexer. And there are five of those. And so 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 we want to be indexed by these Latin American journals. They want an ongoing relationship with these indexers for any subsequent journals they may publish that they want to index there. Okay. But one of those indexers, they couldn't get into. We gave them the lists, and they have a whole indexing division and so forth, abstracting and indexing or whatever. They couldn't get into the website. They couldn't get any contact. So we put Lewis on the job at one of our ed team, and he explained what it was. It's at UNAM, the biggest Mexico, humongous, high quality, northern type. It's not northern, but it's got all the resources of a northern university in Mexico City. It's located there. It's four journals edited in Latin America. And it would be better if we corresponded in Spanish, Lewis said. And so what I've been doing the last couple of days is to try to get Taylor and Francis, I said that all to them. I sent Lewis's email to them. And said, so maybe you want to let Leandro and Lewis make this contact in this case. And the letter back was completely non-comprehending about what the issue was. Because they do have people who can speak Spanish and Portuguese at Taylor and Francis. They have 1,000 employees. Some of those people are going to, at least two or three, are going to speak. But they were interested in getting the Taylor and Francis right to be indexed, and they're not good. In case they have another edited in Latin America journal. So I just wrote back and said, hey, I have a better plan. How about we do Tapuia first, and Lewis and Leandro do it. And then if we can get that, you guys can expand it to include all the possibility of all your other journals. But that's not how they're thinking. And I'm afraid when they see Taylor and Francis wants rights to get indexed, they have 2,500 journals. I mean, in Taylor and Francis, these guys get the word. It would have to be a... Anyway, they can't do that. I can do it.
Right, right. That negotiation.
Yeah.
Yeah. the 2013, you got the Bernal Prize from Forbes.
Yes.
What did you decide to present on and receive the award?
You know what? That was the last year they didn't have presentations. The next year they started presentations. And I can see why. I mean, I just brought the fact that it was me brought to it. You know, have you been at those presentations?
I have.
This was 2013?
Yes.
It's like 5 minutes. You go up and get... In those days,
yeah.
Paul Edwards said a bunch of nice things about me. Half the audience knew who I was, and the other half were clueless.
That's a pretty good ratio.
Pardon?
That's pretty 50%. That's pretty good.
I guess so. Paul told me you have 5 minutes to say something. So I talked about. Who was being betrayed? Was it them? Because I was a philosopher getting this, and for us have been situated, founded in the first place against philosophy. So were they being betrayed? Or was I being betrayed because they didn't understand what I did anyway? And I joked around about that for 5 minutes, and that was it. And then you sit down and you go on to the rest of the program. And that was the last time they didn't have a presentation. They'd never had presentations attached to that. And that was 13, so we're 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19. So 7 years now they've had presentations.
I'm trying to think. 14, do you know where you were when you received that?
San Diego.
In San Diego. Okay, right.
It was 13.
So I actually haven't been. I helped make Trivers with Lucy. Lucy and I made the video for Trevor's in lieu of him being able to be there. But actually, I haven't been.
Is Trevor this year or last year?
He was last year.
2018. Yeah.
Last year. That's right, he was. Yes. Yes. I heard it.
But actually, I haven't seen a presentation.
Is he in any better health than he was?
When we saw him, he was doing pretty well, but I think he's just trying to keep things manageable.
Keeps things manageable, yeah. I love him. I'm so sad.
Yeah, he seemed optimistic, but he's also that kind of person.
Yes, he is.
Yeah. Any other professional groups that you would have regular affiliation with?
So, SGS, APA. I don't go to the National Women's Studies Association groups anymore, though I helped to organize one of them 30 years ago or whatever it was on the East Coast, and went regularly. They were fantastic. They were huge and exciting and all kinds of crazy stuff going on. I took my kids to them a couple of times, and they loved it. For many years, how long? Maybe 15 years. I was very active in a group you probably never heard of, the Society for Values in Higher Education. You know it?
No.
It started out as a Society for Religion in Higher Education, and it was the alumni group for the Danforth Fellowships. So you got a Danforth Fellowship, and when you graduated from graduate school, you got invited to join. And it was a wonderful group. I had a Danforth Fellowship for Women. Danforth had cut out women from their normal fellowships for a 10-year period because women didn't finish their degrees. I can't exactly date these years when it didn't happen. 50s maybe, something like that. Didn't finish at the same rate that men did in 4 years or 5 years or whatever they were doing for Danforth Fellowships. 10 years later, they came back and re-evaluated and discovered if you went to 5 or 6 years, they finished at a much faster rate than men. They had children or whatever, they had domestic duties. So Danforth instituted for 10 years there were fellowships for returning women students, actually. You had to have had a 3-year gap in your education at some point, whether it was undergraduate or graduate. And I had a CV like Jesus Christ. I was out in the wilderness for 12 years or whatever. So I had one for graduate school. And it was a wonderful group. I mean, they were from many different disciplines. It was a week long on a college campus. I took my kids every year. They had all kinds of activities for kids. And there would be, I don't know, 200 people there, maybe 300. And we had self-organized sessions every morning, every afternoon, all through the week, parties, playing around, swimming, whatever. And I became at some point the director of it. I think 2 years before I stopped going. Okay, so that ended, that again, 1985, when I took on that women's studies directorship. I cut out going to a lot of these other meetings. I was at meetings, so I just couldn't do it. And so that was very important to me and created wonderful networks. They had a lot of effort. They were very progressive around black colleges and black faculty, too. So I got to meet and work with up close a number of distinguished black intellectuals, which was a new experience for me and just wonderful. And I would run into these guys and gals later, and it was really nice. Other organizations. So I've mentioned the Latin American Studies group. I've always had these reading groups of one sort or another. And I get invited. I don't have regular relations with and or memberships in, but for many decades I was giving papers and plenaries at American Sociological Association, APSA, 4S, and so forth. I do almost none of that now. I've just backed off.